From the high desert of northern New Mexico, this is Circle for Original Thinking. I am your host, Glenn Aparicio Perry. Welcome to Circle for Original Thinking, America's electronic talking circle for visionary thinkers, an open forum for fresh ideas and timeless wisdom applied to today's political and ecological challenges. Each week, we bring together creative thinkers from a variety of different traditions. We ask the hard questions on the important issues of the day: political polarization, climate change, virulent viruses, and other symptoms of humanity being out of balance with the natural world. Our goal is to recreate a whole and sacred America, a new and improved version of E Pluribus Unum, from the many to the one, and this time not leave anybody out. Join us as we embark on this quest. The past year has brought us an ongoing global pandemic, tremendous social unrest, political polarization, the near complete erosion of truth in politics, the rise of authoritarianism and white nationalism, culminating in the insurrection at the U.S. Capitol. Amid all of this chaos and destruction, where do we find hope? And not just hope based in shallow wish fulfillment, but hope grounded in deep perennial wisdom traditions. Jürgen Kremer and Karen Jenke, editors of Revision Journal, decided to do something to dispel the dismal atmosphere of the past year. They put together an issue of Revision Journal that confronts the shadow side of human history, exploring different stories and worldviews that are expansive, complex, and flexible enough to uplift the spirit. That's what's needed most now. Join us as we explore places of hope in today's edition of Circle for Original Thinking. Now, I want to introduce our guest. Jürgen Kremer received his doctorate in clinical psychology from the Universität Hamburg, Germany. In 1982, Jürgen settled in the San Francisco Bay Area to teach full-time and serve as dean at Seabrook University, and I think later at the California Institute of Integral Studies. That's my alma mater. His teaching and research interests range from general psychology, clinical psychology, and research methods to the relevance of indigenous knowledge for today, as well as ethno-autobiography. For 4 years, he co-directed with Dr. Opila, Colorado, a program for Native American students and others concerned with indigenous roots and origins. Jürgen is widely published, has served on several editorial boards, and been the executive director of Revision, the Journal for Consciousness and Transformation, since 1994. Today, Jürgen is a tenured faculty member at Santa Rosa Junior College. He is also a consultant to the UN University for Peace and its Indigenous Science and Peace Studies program. Now, Karen Jenke, PhD, is chair of the Consciousness and Transformative Studies Master's Program at National University. In 2016, she placed the Consciousness Studies Program online, giving it a global reach. Formerly, she served as director of the Ecotherapy Certificate at John F. Kennedy University from 2011 to 2014, and dissertation director at the Institute of Imaginal Studies in Petaluma, California from 2001 to 2008. And I know that, Karen, you're also a graduate of CIIS. We got a lot of CIIS energy here and a lot of wonderful schools, Institute of Imaginal Studies, JFK also being included. Karen is also the executive director, of course, with Jürgen of Revision, the Journal of Consciousness and Transformation. And she has edited journals and published articles on imaginal psychology, shamanism, and the wounded West, and also earth dreaming, as well as numerous articles on dreams. She is founder of Dream Hut Consulting, which you can find on the web at dreamhut.org. And her creative vision synthesizes dream work, indigenous ways of knowing the subtle body with Gaian or living planetary awareness and more. So welcome to Jürgen and Karen. How are you today?
Thank you. We're hopeful.
Yeah, that's a good
thing. Doing well, yes, indeed.
Good, good. Well,
thank
I'm
you
really
for inviting
looking
us.
Forward to delving. Oh, you're my pleasure, my pleasure. I'm really looking forward to this show. I mean, for me, oddly, I normally love winter. It's my favorite season. I was born in winter. You know, I love everything about winter. You know, it's like a bear going into your cave. It's a wonderful time for deep thinking, reflection. I love the darkness, you know, and that's healing. That's a place of, you know, it almost gives birth. But this year is a little different, you know. This year, I felt like a winter of discontent. I wanted the winter to end. It's the first time I ever felt like that. You know, it was the last winter of the pandemic, the last winter of the Trump administration, and even our doggy died. Sunrise, our beautiful golden retriever. So we just got a new golden retriever, which we call Momo. Momo is Japanese for peach, and he came to us as our peach tree was blooming. So yeah, I mean, there's something very hopeful about this spring. So this is a perfect time to have this conversation. And I want to start with the root of the word hope. And its Indo-European word is from the same root where we derive the word curve or to bend, you know. And it kind of reminds me of what Martin Luther King Jr. said when he was paraphrasing Theodore Parker. And he said, "The arc of the moral universe is long, but it bends toward justice." So what gives both of you hope during these times with the ongoing pandemic, social unrest and inequality, ecological destruction? Stop me, but okay. And the like. So what gives you hope at this time? And Karen, you want to go first?
Well, I do address that at length in my article, which is called Loving Life. Mm-hmm. And that's a clue. For me, the human systems that we're in are in a lot of disarray and frankly not trustworthy as guides of hope. Our Western culture and civilization has many flaws and fragments in it. And so for me, I actually turn toward natural sources of being for hope more than cultural sources. And I talk about that at length in my article in terms of living systems theory as being a guide to how we can love the world, love the living systems that are the foundation of culture and some kind of practices that let us return to natural ways of being. And our authors, actually many of our authors discuss those, is where I find hope, because the intelligent design of the universe that's 14 billion years old, that's a place we can turn when we get into the myopia of the pandemic and the short-term view where things can look dismal in the culture. There's some greater life force energy that has allowed all this beautiful creation to come into existence. And if we can find ways to align with that deeper source of creativity, of life, of evolution, then that's frankly where personally I find the most hope.
Beautiful, beautiful. And thank you. Jürgen, where do you find hope in these times? What gives you hope?
There are kind of two major ways in which I find hope. And one of them may be counterintuitive, the other one may be obvious. The maybe counterintuitive one is the confrontation with all the messy stuff that is difficult. You know, what Jung would call shadow material. And actually, having the courage to go there. And, you know, there are many Jungian sayings to the effect that if we go there, something beautiful can arise. And that's a place from which we can grow if we integrate, trauma, things forgotten, things we have dissociated from. And going into the shadow is actually regenerative. It makes us more whole. And from that, there is a lot of energy, a lot of creative energy that gets released when we actually have the courage to go there. And of course, it is difficult. It's a difficult journey to stand in that place. But when we go to the well of memory, there are wonderful memories, but there are also dark memories, and both are necessary for us to confront and to cherish. It's important that we value what the shadow has to teach us. So that's one source of hope when we actually engage with the shadow material and release creative energies to live our lives. And the second one is primarily nature, and that comes from my autobiography, growing up in Germany after the war. Being in nature was a major place of healing and regeneration for me, and having that connection. Now, when, and this is reflected in a number of the articles that we have, you know, indigenous elders, indigenous traditions talk about the importance of all our relations, and there is no such thing as human exceptionalism. You know, every being, whether it's a mountain, a bird, a mammal, a plant, a human, they all have their place, they all have their role, and they're all part of nature. They're embedded in nature. And so being with a tree, watching the magic of planting a bulb into the soil and having, a flower appear after a while, talking to the birds. You know, with nature, the problem is it's so easy for us to talk to nature. It's much harder for us to listen to nature. But our relationship with nature is a major source of hope for me. And that's where I go. And it always regenerates me and gives me, it gives me courage, gives me strength. It is healing. It is grounding.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Thank you. So I want to ask you guys to walk us through the issue of Revision Journal called Places of Hope. So what did the contributors focus on? And so just give us a little tour through that. You'll start, Karen? Sure.
Yes, I can start. We have an editorial from Lenny Strobel, a very brief letter to the year 2020 that is at the beginning of the issue. And she basically turns many of the conventional attitudes toward 2020 that we heard repeated in the media, you know, the desire to return to normal and dismiss the lessons, the challenges of 2020, just to people wanting to move past it. This is kind of the perspective the media encouraged. And she examines those cultural assumptions, wanting 2020 to disappear from memory, what she calls the tyranny of positive thinking and bright-sightedness, that is an avoidance of the unknown and grief, or in Jürgen's terms, the shadow, bypassing of the shadow that leads to a kind of superficiality. She talks about the fact that we have this illusion that the disruptions haven't always been with us, that from a long-term perspective, there have always been disruptions to human plans, to human systems, and she mentions the fact that in India the virus is a diva, and people make offerings to the goddess of contagion, whereas in the U.S. the virus is an enemy and we're at war. So there's a pretty big contrast of how we approach something like a pandemic and a virus. And she says that hope is offering us an invitation to return to non-human voices, which Jürgen has also just spoken to. And she raises the question, what are the seeds that are buried deep and sprouting deceptively into perfumed blossoms? In other words, that there's something hidden happening in a time like a pandemic, if we can, listen and open to those possibilities. So, she really turns a lot of these, conventional ideas on their head, with a much expanded thinking and points of reference. Then the next one I'll mention is Michael Gray's article. It's called Strumming the Strings of Hope. And he starts with the question, what are the images of hope that flit and dance through our psyches? And there's a suggestion there that the capacities of imagination are part of what allows there to be a hopeful perspective. And he says the future is always open, uncertain, and indeterminate, and never graspable, bit of a Buddhist perspective. And so the openness of the future, the unknownness of the future, means that we project, our own material onto it, and whether those images are hopeful images or images of despair. I'm elaborating here a little bit beyond what he said, in the sense that the future is this projective screen, because it's an unknown. And so whatever is within us is what we tend to project outward onto the screen of the future. And his own hope is nurtured by the beauty of our planet, a theme that's already come up in our conversation, by a circle of friendship, and by ancient traditions that fathom the nature of what it means to be a human being. And in particular, he likes the image of the Buddha, from the Buddhist tradition, of a bird with two wings, one wing representing wisdom and one representing compassion, which suggests a balancing between mind and heart. Now, the interesting thing about his article is that he shares with us that his own sources of hope did not work for his son. And his son was occupying, obviously, a different generation and a different set of life circumstances. And he was unable to find hope in the same things that sustained his father. And he succumbed to what we might call the ultimate act of despair, which to me was such a teaching story, because it really highlights that hope, hangs in the balance, that life and death hang in the balance of hope. And that if the scales tip too far away from hope, life itself is not sustainable. So there's some profound way that hope is woven into, the desire for life, the human and the human spirit. And if it's not, life itself can be extinguished. And this, we see this theme in a couple of other articles that we'll get to later.
Yes, I just want to interject that, I do know Michael, and I know what he's gone through with his son committing suicide. And you framed it very well, Karen. It opens up a lot of deep considerations. I love the way you put that. It really brings us to consider the essence of life. We go beyond even hope, and we're looking at what actually sustains us, what keeps us alive, what nurtures us. Thank you so much. Go on. I'm sorry.
No, yeah. Thank you. Yeah. The you know, for me, the teaching from his article was that the basis of hope is radically situational and deeply personal. That what works for the father doesn't necessarily work for the son. And each person has to find within their own life circumstances fountain of hope. Admittedly, our individual life circumstances are vastly different. So hope is not necessarily transferable from one person to the other. It's from my view, the lesson is that it's a unique psycho-spiritual process to be discovered and nurtured afresh in each human heart. And of course, some life circumstances make it more challenging to do that. And I'll just say in passing here, which is something we might want to return to, is that his article highlights the role of worldview, of a person's worldview and maybe their spiritual worldview as the soil for hope. And some worldviews are more adequate than others to sustain hope and to give rise to hope. And so we'll examine this further with a number of the authors. This is a big theme for me that came up in receiving these articles, is that the role of the world, of a worldview. And that worldview has to encompass, you know, the things that a person has lived through, as well as what they witness around them, as well as what the cultural zeitgeist is bringing. If the worldview can't handle all of those things, then there's cracks that in which despair could, you know, come in. So I was going to cover the next article as well, and it's a brief one, so I'll just touch this one, and then Glenn will come to your article. So get ready. We have two authors that write about and find inspiration in the example of a single, highly evolved human being, and you're one of them. And the other one, and this single, highly evolved human being leads a life that is anchored in spiritual discipline and spiritual devotion. And they're both elders, actually, also, these figures that inspire admiration. So one of the authors that wrestles with this and uses the example of a person who's done their spiritual work and is sort of an exemplar human being is Kimmy Johnson. And she writes an article called The Lone Monk. And it follows, she has a vivid dream of an ashen landscape of total destruction. Everything is just gray ash. It's an image of our worst collective nightmare, you might say, of a totally devastated landscape. And she sits with this dream, heavy dream, shadow dream, we might say, the potential shadow of Western civilization or even our planetary demise. And some short time later, she sees the image of a lone monk walking with absolute equanimity through a barren landscape, very similar to the landscape she saw in her dream. And he's ringing a bell as he walks. So kind of a stately walk through this ashen landscape in a place of total equanimity. And the lesson there is that the depth of a spiritual practice that can meet such a devastating scenario where a person can keep walking forward. And that's a good segue to your article, which also starts with a similar image of a human being who is inspiring to you. So tell us about that.
Well, I think you're referring to Grandfather Leon Secatero, who was a deep inspiration for me. He was the kindest and most patient man I've ever met. He spoke with the softest, most mellifluous voice. You know, I first met him in 1999. We had a dialogue circle, and this was a dialogue circle that brought together Native elders and Western scientists. And Leon was speaking, and there was a learning curve for the audience, I would say, because this would never have happened in a future year. But this was the first year. The audience became some dear friends, actually, and incredibly enlightened, evolved people. But that first year, there was a woman in the back of the room who, when Leon was speaking in a soft, mellifluous voice, she said, "Can you speak louder?" And then a Native person, Rose Van Tatter Braun, actually, immediately said, "Can you move closer?" See, that is, you don't normally, you don't ask a Native elder to speak louder, you move closer. And that's the way Leon was. He was very magnetic in his personality and the way that he spoke. And in fact, people were attracted to him and attracted to his message. And I was very affected by a lot of the things that the way that he lived, mainly, because he really had gotten past historical trauma, and he would say that to me, and I'm sure to many others, that you know, it's time to get past historical trauma. And he was the head man of the Canyon Sito Band of Navajo, so they had suffered, of course, during the Lincoln administration. There was the Long Walk, where the Navajo were rounded up from Canyon de Chelly and walked over 300 miles over to Fort Sumner. And then through a great intervention of divine intervention, they were allowed to return. In fact, Leon used to tell the story about that, about how the reason why they returned is they were very all depressed. They were living in Fort Sumner. It was really a poor quality soil, hard place to actually survive. They were also put there with the Mescalero Apache, their enemies. And then they kept asking the medicine person to say whether they would be allowed to return, and he wouldn't answer their question. They asked him, pleaded with him for months, and then finally the medicine man said, "There will be a messenger that will come into camp, and he will tell you what our future is." And that next morning, a coyote came into camp. And if the coyote had gone to the north, they would perish. If the coyote would gone to the east, they would perish. If the coyote would go to the south, they would perish. But the coyote went west, which is the way they went back to their homeland. So anyway, I digress, but the article I actually wrote was mostly about fear, hope, and love, because I feel that our fear is our hope unmasked, and our hope is our fear unmasked. And what I mean by that is a little similar to what Gibran said about your joy is your sorrow unmasked, because in fact, we tend to hope for things that we to get away from our fears. And the message that Leon taught me is to accept as a blessing whatever has happened. That was the most profound message, and that's what he, in fact, prayed all the time to, and generally to the west direction, by the way. It's interesting. And that was the direction of the ancestors, to be thankful to the ancestors for everything that has happened to bring us to this moment in time. So to accept everything as a blessing. So that is truly a profound lesson. And that's what ultimately leads us to love, or you might say unconditional love, but I wonder if there is any love that is other than unconditional. So love is, I would say, always unconditional. All right, go on, and we have another maybe 10 more minutes we could devote toward walking through the issue, and then I have a couple more questions for you guys. So go on. I think Jürgen, you're going to introduce some more, correct? Thank you.
So let me weave things a little bit together here at this point. We talked about suicide as the ultimate act of despair and hopelessness. And I think in our society, there is a disconnection from all the sources that could nurture us, that really could feed our self. And Karen earlier talked about the importance of worldview. There's no culturally given worldview that nurtures us. And we can see this, so to speak, on the dark side when we go up to the Inuit cultures. The destruction of their cultural ways has led, I believe this is still true, the highest rate of suicide, because all the natural sources of what someone makes an Inuit and nurtures and feeds an Inuit, not just physically feeds, but spiritually feeds, have been destroyed. And it is this connection. So when we are faced with despair, we're faced with despair and hopelessness in an individualistic way, in a way that is disconnected from what could feed us. So our sense of self is a problem here, and Durkheim, talked about anomie and, that cultural imbalance. The two articles I want to talk about really address this. Lily Mendoza talks in her article about her encounter with her cultural roots and how she was deeply moved when she encountered and really studied Filipino art. And that gave her hope because there was an alternate story. And it gives inspiration as, she describes the dark night of the soul experience of our times where so many things are going wrong. So for her, remembering and seeing her own indigenous roots as a source of hope is something that inspires her and allows her to imagine a different type of future. Now, from a different traditional point of view, Paul Callahan, who is an Australian Aborigine, he talks about what in Australia the natives call the law, or in his language, Nugurampa, which is the lore, which is, what on this continent at times is called original instructions, which is how to take care of a place, how to be in a place, how to honor a place. And his fundamental thesis is we're living in a bad story. We're living bad stories, and we should live as his elders say, make it the best story that we can possibly can. And he tells an emu story and discusses it and invites the reader to look at their own meeting. And these ancient stories, we so often dismiss them as mythology, but they're really rich psychological teachings that don't look like a psychology textbook, but that really allow us to go deep, connecting our sense of self with nature and with place. So here we have the inspiration of hope through the honoring of all the beings that live in that particular ecology. And I turn it over to Karen.
I will go to Helen Solma's article, Helena Solholm, sorry, who gives us a story. perfect segue there. She gives us a story of the Korean, from a Korean myth of Princess Berry. This is a girl who is born in grim circumstances. She's and has a poor fate from the beginning. She experiences total family rejection. Her family wanted a boy, and so she's banished from all the supportive network of her family. And she ends up going on a solo journey into the underworld, the heroine's journey to the underworld, where she finds her life purpose and healing medicine for the family, the original family rejecting situation. But she goes through years of toil and suffering, and her mission is completed when she saves her parents, the same people that rejected her, and she returns as a powerful healer. And she's given a sacred title, Mudong in Korean, I hope I'm pronouncing it correctly, which means shaman. And she's worshipped thereafter as the patron goddess of shamans. And Solholm finds that her story has relevance to our current situation, where the princess steps into her power to serve in the most meaningful and compassionate way. And it involves healing her personal trauma of abandonment, helping those who've caused her pain. And through this, she demonstrates the ultimate love of a true healer. And her story also illustrates that the focus begins on the individual journey, but ends in addressing the needs of the group. And she feels that this gives us a template for how to approach uncertainty and crisis. And she thinks Solholm sees the arrival of COVID-19 as also a hidden opportunity to take an inward journey, to sit with oneself and in the midst of lockdown and restrictions, and to travel inwards. And it's a time to let go of the distraction and disconnection and dissociation that characterize much of modern life. She also says that even though the pandemic will leave a lasting scar, it brings the possibility of the death of outdated and outmoded patterns that force us to face a novel and unknown world. So she sees it as kind of a breaking of habituation and an opening to looking deep within and looking to other sources of hope and well-being.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Wow, this is going to be quite the issue. So, you know, revision journal is a very, I don't want to make you blush, both of you, but, you know, revision journal is a very high level journal, and I've been blessed. I mean, this is an audio podcast, but I happen to have a revision journal here from, 2004, that was on the language of spirituality, which was a conference we later called the language of spirit, the conference I referenced earlier that brought together native elders and Western scientists. And I think of that very issue. I read many times thank you. You got it right there, huh? I have read that issue many, many times, and some of the deepest wisdom I've found is in there. So, you know, I'm going to make you guys blush, but I think what you're doing is really important for the world. And thank you for sharing, giving us a tour through the the issue. I know there might be a couple more people left. I do have a couple of questions I want to ask you guys, if that's okay. So for you, Jürgen, I was really thinking about how a lot of your work is about confronting the shadow and decolonizing historical narratives, and you're one of the premier thinkers in delving into the roots of being white, frankly, and being on white supremacy, how that came about. And you've also given a lot of thought to how to revision psychology. I'm grateful that you seem to be inspired by James Hillman too. I'm also very much inspired by James Hillman. We did a conference with James, brought him to Albuquerque, and also in 2004 it was called Art and Soul. One of my heroes, and ultimately your work is really about decolonizing the mind. You know, I mean, it's so. I want to ask you, you know. What do you think is the opportunity here? In recent times, we had the Trump administration, and as dangerous as his presidency may have been, it also, I contend in my book, Original Politics, that was a catalyst for the revealing of the American shadow. So with this, with the shadow coming out and people are able to see it, what is the opportunity here? How can we take advantage of this?
Well, probably the most constructive frame that I can think of for our current situation is it's a possible moment of initiation. And, you know, the different prophecies, native prophecies, and calendars kind of talk about it. You know, when we talk about the end of the Mayan calendar, for example, one of the Mayan daykeepers explained to me, well, you know, that's a portal opening. And, you know, there's a question, will we make it through this portal or not? But it's an opportunity for initiation and for a profound change of understanding who we are as human beings. And this, you know, applies particularly to the dominant cultures in the world. And by dominant cultures, I don't just mean whatever U.S. Hegemony, but a kind of thinking that has split us off from all these sources that can give us hope. You know, when you start looking around, hope is everywhere. You know, I mean, hope is what makes us survive, but hope is everywhere. Inspiration for hope is possible everywhere. But in our Western lives, the way they are constructed, the way we perform our lives, we are disconnected from these sources. So when we encounter despair, it is difficult to access these sources. So part of my reframing of psychology is really looking at the individual not as an enclosed, you know, cut-off monad that is sort of there in a little husk, but really remembering that we have all these interconnections that are there whether we're conscious of them or not. We generally, you know, we have what I call normative dissociation. You know, our culture enforces a splitting off, which puts us above nature and, you know, gives us the illusion that we can control things and that we should control things. But instead, remembering that, you know, we have our own self, our own intentionality, et cetera, but this self is really porous. It's interconnected. It's interconnected with the beings around us, you know, reaching above, reaching below. And so my reframe of psychology really talks about that. And I look at psychology as a transdisciplinary endeavor where, you know, we're focused on the psyche, which originally really is doesn't just mean mind, and it certainly originally psyche doesn't mean behavior. You know, it refers to spirit, it refers to breath, you know. And so remembering that original meaning of psyche, and remembering these interconnections. So I'm reframing what is an individual, which in and of itself I think is healing. And I think this is what this initiatory moment asks of us. We can't go back to normal. You know, so many people say, oh, you know, can't wait for COVID to be over and we'll go back to normal. Well, we cannot, and we certainly should not. You know, if we try to go back, I think it's just perpetrating our past delusions that have not worked. And really, the opportunity is for us to rethink how we relate to each other, to heal racism, to heal inequality, you know, to heal sexism and all the other issues, you know, that are around global heating, et cetera, et cetera. That's the opportunity. And, you know, the beauty of the moment is we have everything that we need to actually make that shift. The question is, do we have the courage to go there? That's the central question. You talked about fear, fear and love. You know, do we have the courage to go through the fear and abandon the crutches that we have developed that in some aspects of life have been incredibly efficient, which is why they're so addictive? You know, we're in an addictive paradigm. But do we have the courage to face, you know, to sort of take the leap into the chasm, into the abyss? And, you know, there's this old story from Maui, which I also write about in my article, where there is an initiation happening where, you know, people go through a dark passage, you know, they go into the underworld, they're confronted with the primordial, they're confronted with the shadow, and at the end of it, you know, they're confronted with death. And I think we're confronted with death. And the question is, what is the choice that we make? And we need to make a conscious choice for life. We need to make a conscious choice for the nurturing conversation with all the beings around us. And that's not a mystery. That's been there all the time. So finding the sources of hope, you know, is just the courage to open our eyes and see what's there, you know, to enjoy the beauty. You know, yesterday in my garden, these bearded irises popped open, and just being with that beauty, or being with the beauty of a hawk flying overhead, or a raven, or whatever it is, and slowing down. Part of it is slowing down. You know, we are at a pace where, you know, we're so accelerated, and our mind process is for sale. Right, that's what social media and all of that is about. Our whatever psychic processes we are, they're now commodities that are for sale. But when we engage in the nurturing conversation and in ritual and ceremony, that's a place of stillness. That's a place of pause. That's a place of stepping back. And it's a place where we don't have to create verbiage. It's a place, you know, where we connect with our wellsprings.
That is so beautiful, Jürgen. Thank you for that. You know, wow. You speak about going through the fear. I can't remember what tribe. I think it's one of the Rosebud Sioux. I think it's the tell the story about how their enemies came once to burn down their village, and they tried to escape, and they were running away from the village, but they were running in the same direction the wind was going, so there was no way they could outrun the fire. And so they made a decision at that moment to turn and run through the fire. And then they ran through the fire, which really is, you know, facing their fears, then they emerged safely on the other side. You know, and it's everything you're speaking about is pretty inspiring. There is a lot of shadow in Western culture, a lot of things we haven't faced. And it seems to me, and you know, you're speaking my language when you use the word original. So I love, that's what I really think we need to return to, not just original instructions, but, you know, the last week we were interviewing Jeremy Johnson and Barbara Carlson were on the podcast, and we were talking about Gebser, you know. So I mean, then the German philosopher, who I'm sure you're very familiar with, and maybe you've even read him in the original. Ursprung und Gegenwart. Am I pronouncing that right? The ever-present origin in English, and you know, he basically said that to get to the core of his message, you know, that Western culture had confused distance from the origin and named it progress. You know, so we've become addicted to this concept of progress, and it's kind of a virus in Western culture. Besides the coronavirus, there's the virus of progress. So I want to turn to you, Karen, and ask you, because you've did some beautiful writing on this very subject. So, you know, how do we return to the rhythms of nature, you know, and reconnect with place? I love the title of your issue, Places of Hope, because place is very critical to hope, it seems to me. So how do we return, Karen, to the rhythms of nature instead of the artificial demands of progress? I know you have a lot to say about that, so I turn it over to you.
In my article, I do look at living systems theory as, which, you know, many people think of as an abstract system, and it does have some abstractions in it. But what I try to do is extract the basic principles of living systems theory and apply them personally, which is something that hasn't been done very much. We usually think of it as applied to families or other larger systems. And at the heart of that living systems theory is feedback loops and our participation. We as human beings can participate consciously in feedback loops in a way that maybe is distinct from how nature is participating in feedback loops. And so I look at the way the feedback loop, three feedback loops that human beings have kind of a privileged access to. One is the feedback loop of affect regulation. So that's the ability to regulate our own emotional states and channel those emotional states in creative ways instead of destructive ways. That ability is disrupted by trauma, which is something we've been talking about off and on through this conversation. So it's not automatic if you didn't have good attachment as a child that you have good affect regulation. I personally didn't. So I've had to spend a lot of years of my adult life learning affect regulation. But that enables a person to come back into balance with themselves instead of acting out their emotional states on other people or their environment. A second feedback loop that I look at is dreams. Dreams is the way that the unconscious, we've been also talking about the shadow and the unconscious, is a way that that material rises into awareness. If we work with our dreams, the shadow is right there, ready to greet us. So one of the ways we can integrate the shadow personally is through doing consistent dream work and learning the language of our dreams, learning how they speak a symbolic language, and being in relationship with that. Jürgen has said that our dreams are the place where the presence of the ego is diminished. And so we get access to that transpersonal wellspring of energy. It's also this source of hope that Jürgen was talking about earlier. And then the third feedback loop that I look at is the body and the subtle body. This is kind of not known very widely, except in esoteric circles, that there are circuits of energy that run through the human body. And we can connect with those circuits of energy. And those are inherently pleasurable. It's a little bit like living in a pseudo-orgasmic state to connect with those energy circuits. And spiritual you can connect with those through intense spiritual practices, mindfulness practices, dream practices. And so back to your question about how we connect with nature, this is nature running through our own bodies, these energy circuits. And the beautiful thing about the subtle body and our connection with the subtle body is that the subtle body mediates our connection, our sense of connection with the world and with our environment. You might think of it as a kind of mediating intelligence. In when we're connected with the subtle body, our sense of separateness is diminished, and we can feel the energy field around us. We can feel the environment. We feel that we're in a vibrational wholeness with our immediate surroundings through the energy body, through the subtle body, or sometimes it's called the dream body. It opens us to this subtle dimension of awareness, which I connect with what Jürgen was saying earlier about the porous self. This is where the self becomes porous to the world, is through the energy body or the subtle body. So, and then we feel the bodies of others. We feel the bodies of the plants. We feel the bodies of animals. We can feel, it's through that mechanism of the subtle body that we can feel into and relate to the vibratory aliveness of another being.
Yeah. Yeah, I really appreciate that, Karen. You know, it's you wrote beautifully about our hope dwelling in loving life. You know, so it's just connecting to that, to all of nature and in those vibrations. You know, one of the things we can connect to, in fact, we were speaking about it last week with Barbara Carlson, is the microbial life within us, because that really is an enormous part of our body garden, you know, and it's kind of challenging for people today, because obviously the coronavirus is so very virulent, and people have died, people have been very sick, and some have had, you know, repercussions they can't get over with easily. But normally speaking, our microbial gut, you know, is giving us a lot of positive energy, and in fact, when your gut is happy, you're happy, you know. And so you're kind of instinctually connecting to the world, and in a way that you also wrote about, you know, about the human well-being is connected with planetary well-being, and I couldn't agree more. I mean, it's the more that we just feel ourselves vibrating with the natural world, and the less that we're obsessed with our own personal human issues and our own human agendas, we'll be happier. You know, I mean, human beings have understood this for a very long time. I mean, the Tao Te Ching, you know, guides people to, you know, humans to follow nature, but for some reason we've gone away from that perennial wisdom. But hopefully we're getting back to that. Yes, you know, and Jürgen, please, if you'd like to add something,
I just want to highlight something that was said, which is, you know, for thousands of years, humans have understood interconnection and valued interconnection, and it's in all the traditional spiritualities, indigenous traditions, etc., etc. And there was an understanding of our spirituality. And what's happening now when you talk about the microbial world is kind of science criticizes his own paradigm, because it, you know, it makes it apparent that our separateness is actually an illusion. So even the so-called hard sciences show us that the paradigm of the separate individual really is dysfunctional and not true. It's not who we are. We are interconnected on spiritual levels, on physical levels, on all different levels. And it's really another call for Western science to rethink its epistemology, ontology, and ethics. And that's, you know, part of the initiatory move that I think needs to happen at this time.
Ah, that's perfect. That's perfect. I mean, at the end of my book, Original Politics, I shared the story, which I'm sure you've probably heard, about Ramana Maharshi being asked, how should we treat others? And his reply was, there are no others. So ultimately, we are radically interconnected with all there is. We are the light, we are the air, we are the water, we are the earth. And we three are in a good connection today, and I feel very blessed by this program, Places of Hope. Thank you so much, Jürgen. Thank you so much, Karen. This program is made possible in part by Select Books, Waterside Publications, BizGenix, and Web Talk Radio. Native flute music by Orlando Secatero from the Pathways CD. Liberty Song by artist Ron Crowder, written by Ron Crowder, Jim Casey, and Danny Casey. Post-production editing by Scout Media Strategies. The Circle for Original Thinking is a grassroots think tank whose mission is to seek out the deep origins of contemporary thought in order to remember and restore heart-centered wisdom for humanity and all our relations on Earth. For more information or to volunteer to help produce this podcast, go to originalthinking.us or originalpolitics.us, and you can also find and purchase my books, Original Thinking and Original Politics, there. Thank you for listening. Thank you, Jürgen. Thank you, Karen. Until next week, many blessings of good health and well-being to you. Sweet liberty.